When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYN ads.com.
Welcome to the Intelligence Squared podcast. I'm producer Catherine Hughes. In today's episode, we're bringing you a live recording from our Intelligent Times event series, which took place in collaboration with the New York Times. In this conversation, recorded in 2019, award-winning actor Willem Dafoe speaks to the New York Times European culture editor Matthew Anderson. Together, they discuss Dafoe's long and varied career, his approach to acting, and his understanding of the changing film industry. Part two of this event is available ad-free for subscribers now. And for our listeners who don't subscribe, part two will be available in our next episode.
Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen, and thank you, Willem, for joining us this evening. Willem Dafoe, everyone knows him. He's done every conceivable type of picture. He's done superhero movies, he's done highbrow auteur numbers, Hollywood blockbusters, and experimental curios. And we all recognize that incredibly expressive face, but we also know the voice, which is voiced animation numbers and narrated documentaries as well. In more than 40 years, Willem, you have done more than 120 pictures, and you've garnered 4 Oscar nominations. And that's not to mention the experimental theater that you have done with the Worcester Group. So getting ready for this interview, I was looking through IMDb and looking at all of the roles that you've played. And, you know, it ranges everything from the Green Goblin in Spider-Man, a pot-smoking Vietnam vet in Platoon, kindly manager of a flea pit hotel in the Florida Project, the voice of a cheeky rat in The Fantastic Mr. Fox, and not to mention historical figures, Vincent van Gogh, Pier Paolo Pasolini, T.S. Eliot, and even Jesus of Nazareth. I was at a bit of a loss to where could I find the through lines and how could I sort of draw it all together? And it's certainly a crazy collection. What's the method in your madness when you're choosing these roles?
It's always different every time, and also you're talking about 40 years of working, so I've changed, my methods changed. But one of the things that's beautiful about working in the movies, or for that matter, working in the theater, is it is different every time because your job is slightly different, the approach has to be different, and who your colleagues are is different. And I like that. So it really gives you the opportunity to take different points of view and try out different things. Certainly, there's certain things that, you know, you return to, and if they work for you, they tend to be safe places for you. But sometimes even those, you can't go to them, given the nature of what your expectation is.
In that list, I'm not seeing a lot of safe places.
It's funny, I get it, but I feel much more comfortable when I feel like I'm sticking my neck out than I'm doing something familiar. And I would probably say that the most difficult roles to do for me are when I've gotten into a situation where I've really arrived at it, and I'm not... you lose your curiosity, or you think you know what it is, and then you just execute. You just apply a kind of technique to it. I think it's often best to be a little off balance. And if you get used to being off balance, that's a place of strength. And I try to find that place. I guess that would be the through line. I try to find that place where you're, you know, sometimes you have to trick yourself where you're curious, you're receptive, you're, you know, open to having an experience. It's not something you know. You're going towards something. You're trying to learn something. And then once you learn something, you have a shift of how you think, and a new way of being is suggested. And if you're willing to apply that to another scenario that isn't your life, then that's when you start to feel, you know, flexible and feel like you're, you know, being that character.
One thing I did notice was there's a lot of very strong directors who have very definite visions of what they want, recognizable visual styles or very particular ways of working. And I was thinking particularly about Wes Anderson and David Lynch, some who you've worked with. Wes Anderson, you've done a lot of pictures with. What is it about him that attracts you?
His precision, the fact that there's no one, you see a Wes Anderson movie and it's his view of the world, or it's got a very personal stamp on that. And I think I like that. I when I see someone that has a very, very particular way of working or a particular way of looking at the world, I like attaching myself to them and going towards their mentality and trying to embody that, trying to help them do what they can't do because they're on the other side of the camera.
It was Steve.
So like being an extension of them. Those are the happiest situations, because there's something about, I mean, this is suspicious because actors are, you know, notoriously egocentric, but, you know, really to free yourself, you have to get rid of yourself and attach yourself to something that's, you've got to reach for, I think, and you've got to learn something. You've got to extend yourself. And when you have a strong director, your appetite for doing that is much stronger, and you feel clearer.
Did you know his pictures before you?
I did.
Yeah. So it was The Life Aquatic was the first one that you.
Yes, but I knew his pictures, and he used to come to the theater, and I met with him, and it's kind of interesting because I said, at one point I said, Wes, I'd love to work with you. And he said, yeah, well, you know, I've just cast this movie, Life Aquatic, and it's going to be quite a long process. And I'll see you in 5 years, basically. And then he called me a couple months later, and he said, someone dropped out.
Who was that?
I won't give you the name, but I'll give you a little game. I give you some details and then you can figure it out, but I'm not going to say
okay,
yes or no.
Okay, we'll do it that way.
A European character actor who took another job for the money and I'm not going to give his name.
The character you ended up playing, Klaus Daimler, he's a
Klaus
sort of German
Daimler, and
he's a sort of German blowhard, isn't he?
Beautiful role. And something, you know, and particularly when I was younger, touring a lot with the Wooster Group, we toured a lot in Germany. So I had a real feeling for the kind of myth of German efficiency.
Yeah.
And growing up in a very Germanic part of the United States, also I knew that as well. So I thought there was something very charming about that character, about...
When you're working with Wes Anderson, you know, I think we can see, looking at it, that he's got a sort of very clear sense of what he... But how does he communicate that to you as an actor? How do you know what he wants you to do?
You know, he's very good at working with what you're bringing to it. But I must say that the way he worked in Life Aquatic is very different than the way he worked, like, in Grand Budapest Hotel, for example. Because Life Aquatic, there was much looser approach. He shot these very, very long shots, and he'd kind of fold different elements into it. He had the basic idea, and sometimes we'd work all day on choreographing and timing out for the camera and for the actors a shot that might last several minutes and had lots of working pieces. If you think of his movies, if you know his movies, I'm sure you can imagine this. We'd work on it all day, and then we'd shoot at the end of the day, and if we got one take that was good, we'd go home. Or we'd keep on working until we got it, but no coverage. And that was very different than Grand Budapest, where it was very precise.
To me, that sounds awful, Willem, like all of this effort just for one shot.
No, it's wonderful. You know, it's like some people think, wow, you know, he's got such a specific idea. Wouldn't that be suffocating? Where am I being creative? The truth is, and I think this has a lot to do with my background in the Wooster Group, I started out as a really task-oriented actor, and what I love more than anything else is knowing what I have to do and try to doing it with a kind of grace and a kind of openness that something happens to me while I'm doing it. Just like an athlete, it doesn't sound very sexy to run from here to there. But, you know, in that running from here to there, there's a lot going on. So sometimes it's good to have a very strong structure, very strong actions.
And you've just been working with him on his latest picture, The French Dispatch, which I understand is just wrapped in Angoulême in France.
Yes.
And not a lot is known about it at the moment. What would you like to tell us about it?
The events calendar is filling up here at Intelligence Squared, and to create each one, we obviously rely on some brilliant guests and onstage talent. But behind the scenes, there's also a producer, a production team, and the budget in the mix too. You've got to keep an eye on all of that stuff in one place. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. And you can cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because it's super easy to get started. NetSuite exists in the cloud, you see, no hardware needed, so you're cutting IT costs too. That's why over 37,000 companies have already made the move. And now, by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/squared. That's netsuite.com/squared. netsuite.com/squared.
You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYN ads.com.
I'm sort of in the dark too.
Yeah.
Because, to be honest, I was very happy to be there, but it's essentially a cameo.
Okay.
I worked a couple of days, but very happily.
I'm looking forward to this one because it's about journalists.
Yes, very much.
Yeah. You were talking before about your accent, and so you're from the Midwest, from Wisconsin, and you grew
where
up...
Where we talk like Fargo.
Yeah.
You know, kind of like that. You know, hey, guys, let's go down to the store and watch them unload the trucks, eh? A little bit like that. And all my sisters, I have five sisters, and they all have high voices, and they all do sing-song. I love them, but boy.
You've got a lot of brothers and sisters, don't you?
Yeah.
You're eight, I believe.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, and so your father is a surgeon, and your mother is a nurse.
Yes.
It's a big family.
Yeah.
In the Midwest of America, was it quite a sort of conservative environment that you grew up
in?
Yeah,
they were basically Eisenhower Republicans. But then I was toward the end of the family, and I saw, you know, very much, because I was born in 55, so as I was a teenager, I'd see all my brothers and sisters coming home from university, and most of them went to the University of Wisconsin, and that was one of the hotbeds of student activity. So there were all these classic, you know, Christmas nightmarish scenes, you know, where they'd be discussing politics, and, you know, my brothers and sisters would be coming back with, you know, off the pigs and stuff like that. My parents were like, what? How did this happen? You know? So I was witness to that, and I guess what that told me is there's a bigger world out there.
Yeah. Well, in 1976, you ran away to join the theater, and you arrived in New York City.
Pretty much. I always felt like that. I mean, it was a good place to grow up. It was a paper mill town of like 50,000 people. It's where it was Joe McCarthy's district, you know, Joe McCarthy from...
Senator McCarthy of the House Un-American Activities Committee.
And it's also where Harry Houdini grew up.
Yeah.
I think
and
he was Romanian.
Too.
But, yes, yeah. And a couple of times on talk shows, I can't go back to Appleton anymore because I've used that joke, basically. What was the greatest escape from Appleton?
Yeah. You know.
And what was Houdini's greatest escape from Appleton? Yeah. That's it. So I keep on going with this. It's like,
but so you've escaped from there and you've arrived in New York City in 1976, and that's where you became involved with the Wooster Group, a sort of experimental theater group, which is known throughout the world, which really does some very very avant-garde and very genre pushing types of theatre. So Elizabeth Leconte, who is your former partner and who is the director of the theatre, in an interview with the New York in 2007, she described it, the early days of the Wooster Group, as a French farce of exits, a big, close, arty, eccentric, libidinous extended family. Sounds like fun.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the joke is when I went to New York, I had already done some theater work, but not extensive. But I went there and I fully intended to try to be a commercial theater actor. But when I got there, I found myself always going downtown, you know, always going to loft performances, always seeing dance. I found myself being attracted to those people. And one of the things that I loved is I wasn't quite down with like an amateur aesthetic, but I was down with the fact that they weren't careerists. And they were living their lives like artists, you know? And being from the Midwest, I suppose, and having the background that I did, this was very exciting to me. I liked being around these people. So I found myself kind of being less and less interested in pursuing a career path and just wanted to be with those people. So I started working very modestly at the Wooster Group, you know, doing carpentry and doing small roles. I fell in love with the director, that... you know, thickened the plot, certainly. Yeah. I was there with them for 27 years, and it really shaped who I am as an actor. I mean, it really formed who I was, who I am. And one of the significant things, it's always hard because I don't know what you know about the Wooster Group, for example. But
why don't you describe it for the uninitiated?
It's hard to describe, but... where it's at in the world, and I'm looking back on it, what I think is interesting, that was a time in New York City. Remember, those are the days of New York City being bankrupt,
being dangerous, rough,
and it was, you know? And there was a huge movement of people just making things, and there was a cross-fertilization. Dancers were making films, filmmakers were making music, actors were dancing. It was all mixed up. And the Wooster Group was, in fact, not a company of actors and people that had been trained in the theater. They were architects, poets, musicians, seamstresses. It was people that weren't trained, weren't on a career path, and they just came together. And
I mean, what they made was pretty weird, wasn't it? So, for instance...
Not weird. It wasn't weird to us.
In 1984, in a play called LSD, Just the High Points, that was a mashup of Arthur Miller's The Crucible with the writings of Timothy Leary and members recounting their own experiences of acid trips. That sounds kind of weird to me.
Out of context, that does sound kind of weird, but... No, we had unusual rehearsal techniques, for example. For that show, we dropped acid and rehearsed a scene from The Crucible. And as you can imagine, it didn't go so well. But but we recorded it. We filmed it. And when we played back the tape, it was interesting enough that we time-coded it and then reproduced that as part of the performance and turned it basically into a dance, second by second. And the task was to be as truthful to the time code and to recapture the timing of these things happening. And it was fascinating from an actor's point of view, because we were all at a long table rehearsing, and it would be like you'd have a rhythm in your head, and you knew when you did that with your hand, I knew 2 seconds later I would touch that, and then I had 3 seconds to put my hand on my head, and then I'd look up, and then I'd say a line. It was crazy. It was crazy. It really broke it down into a series of actions, and that was real pleasurable to perform and interesting.
Yeah, I mean, it became a real mainstay of experimental theatre in New York for many years. We had a bit of it here in London. You came through the Barbican, used to do Lift and whatever. But in Europe, it was known as the plays that everyone walked out of. So once again, Elizabeth LeConte to the Elizabeth LeConte said to the New Yorker, the Germans walked out of the plays about women, the French walked out of the plays about men, the Scots and the Spaniards and the Austrians walked out, period.
She's talking about after I left.
No. What's that like when you're in a production?
We were pretty reviled for many years, and what was interesting is it was really through European co-productions that supported us, mostly from Germany, Belgium, France. A little bit, we performed some. There was a period where we performed at places like the Tramway in Glasgow, which was a great venue once upon a time. And we performed in London at the place that Hitchcock used to, Riverside Studios, you know. Funky place, but alive, you know. Off the grid, but good places to perform. But we were pretty much reviled, and then Liz had the smart idea to not allow critics to come because they were writing so terribly about us.
I can't get behind this one. But yeah.
But listen, and so we did that for a little while, and then we started basically making our reputation and our you know, earning our keep, making our nut in Europe and elsewhere. Touring internationally. And then it was then that people in the States started seeing us in another context, like in Paris, you know, at the Beaubourg or someplace like that, and see us received very well. And then, miracle of miracles, when we came home, now all of a sudden they embraced us. So it was interesting to see that.
So, I mean, through the 80s, you're doing a lot of this very crazy theater in Europe and in America, but your big break comes in 1987 with Platoon.
Yes, that was important, but when you talk about big break, you know, the big break is the first thing you do. You know, is Catherine Bigelow coming and seeing me at a show at the Wooster Group and asking me to do a movie with her. That was the initial big break to my mind.
I mean, but this one got you an Oscar nomination and worked with Oliver Stone.
That's true. That's true. It raised the profile, certainly.
Mm. Oliver Stone is known as one of the sort of maddest directors to work with. What was that like, putting Platoon together with him?
It was great. I mean, I worked with him twice, most notably on Platoon. And I remember when I met him, I thought, wow, I've never met anyone in the movie business like this. Because he didn't suffer fools, and he had a personal story to tell, and he was going to do anything to tell it. And he was connected to that story. So he got a bunch of kids that weren't very experienced, and we went to the Philippines, and they threw us in the jungle, and they got some hardcore military people, many of them veterans of that war, to train us, and we learned how to do things. We learned how to, you know, set an ambush. We learned how to land navigate. We learned how to use those weapons, and then we shot this movie. So it was very special, very particular, and I loved doing it. And as far as him being a strong personality, I don't know. It never occurred to me. I mean, he likes to turn up the heat, and sometimes he likes to push people. I don't normally respond to that. And he probably never tried it with me. He probably has a good sense. Sometimes he felt like if he turned up the heat and he pushed someone, that they would go to a place that they wouldn't go normally, and then when that happened, they'd thank him. But I never liked that too much. When people, you know, ride actors push them.
He was a Vietnam vet himself. He went twice, I believe.
Say again?
I believe he went twice to Vietnam in active service.
I forget, yes.
Yeah. And so the sort of process of making you go through that...
Oh, he had a huge stake in it, you know, and not only as actors, but you wanted to honor that, you know. You were telling his story. Also, there were other people there. Captain Dale Dye. We got their stories in our head, and we tried to... Of course, we're not soldiers, we're not... But we did the best we could to try to tell that story.
And in America itself, that film had a huge impact and actually really changed the way that people thought about Vietnam vets.
I think so, because really. I'm involved. You never know the truth, you know. But, yes, people started talking about their nightmarish personal experiences, where before they wouldn't dare, just because there was so much shame involved. And this was not a flag raiser. It wasn't talking down the people, the soldiers that served there, or the political situation specifically. That just introduced what an incredibly difficult task they had, and how much waste there was.
I mean, as an actor, that must be a wonderful feeling to have taken part in something which has had a real sort of social impact like that.
It was, yes. Yeah.
Another difficult director you've worked with is Lars von Trier.
A great director.
So you've done a couple of his pictures, but Antichrist is probably the one which in which you had the largest role. It's just you and Charlotte Gainsbourg, really, in that picture. Once again, that was a very controversial movie when that came out.
Right. Yeah, it's a strong movie.
Yeah.
And I think it dealt with a lot of taboo subjects. And I always think it's funny that he was charged with being a misogynist, where he always takes the woman's point of view. In his movies, and this movie is very much about, for me anyway, it's very much about the difficulty of a woman, you know. Well, there's many things, but one of the strong things is, you know, sexuality and motherhood, and also there's stories about, you know, there's themes of magic and things that we don't understand, and kind of a pragmatic approach represented by my character.
What's that like when the picture comes out and then it goes crazy, and the people are arguing about it and fighting about it, and you've got to face difficult questions in interviews? Do you like being in those kind of movies, or that kind of the outrage that they cause, or you'd rather do a bit of a quieter one and have a bit of an easier ride?
Listen, I think there was outrage just because it's a strong movie, and it's as I said, it's dealing with some very taboo subjects, but I think they're taboo subjects dealt in a very beautiful way, and if people were smarter, they would just smile and love it. The point is, I don't get any particular pleasure out of controversy. For example, Last Temptation of Christ was a beautiful movie, I thought, and was a great experience for me. And it broke my heart a little bit to see that its reception was very overshadowed by a debate about the movie, mostly by people that hadn't seen it.
Well, exactly. Well, so maybe if we could go back to that in 1989, the release of the movie, and there was a big sort of, as you say, people who hadn't seen the movie were already getting warmed up for it. And then on August the 13th, 1989, in the New York Times, it says, after a month of protests and angry rallies by groups that consider the movie blasphemous, Martin Scorsese's Last Temptation of Christ opened today to long lines and sold-out theaters. There was a statement from Mother Teresa who said, our Blessed Mother Mary will see that this film is removed from your land. Mother Angelica called it sacrilegious. Catholic and Greek Orthodox bishops, they weighed in. The head of the American Family Association said, anyone who shows it in their movie theater, we're going to put you on a blacklist for a year. And a cinema in Paris that was showing it was actually firebombed.
And where are all these people when there's slasher movies and porn, you know, shown? This is a movie about spirituality.
Well, it is, definitely. And I mean, the thing that people really got in a flap about was the fact that it's a movie. It shows Jesus, who you play, as a fallible human character. And it was the lust, I think, that really got them.
Put him over the top.
Yeah. but he had other...
Really got them there.
But he had other real human, not
yes.
failings, but complexities to his character, didn't he?
I think so. And, you know, I knew there was, when the novel came out, there was some controversy, but we were approaching this in such a sincere, thoughtful way, particularly Marty, Martin Scorsese, that I didn't anticipate there being a problem. I think it was at a point, particularly in America, I can't talk about other places. I can't talk about Mother Teresa, but she had her hands full. In America, it was a moment where the religious right needed something to rally around. And they kind of organized their agenda around this movie. So it became a pulpit for them to preach from. So it really wasn't about the movie. If they saw the movie, in fact, you know, many places with time, particularly in Catholic countries, the movie's finally shown and been accepted even by, you know, the Catholic, by Catholic organizations.
So Martin Scorsese, you knew him already before you did that picture?
I knew his movies,
yeah.
But I didn't know him.
Uh-huh.
I didn't know him, no.
Yeah, and when...
Out of the blue.
Did you just go to think, oh, I fancy reading for Jesus? How did it work?
actually, the funny part is everybody and their brother... I mean, I'm working in the theater and I'm doing movies here and there, you know. But my identity still is I'm a theater actor. That's what I'm doing day to day. And I remember everybody and their brother had auditioned for this movie, and they never even asked to see me, and I never went in on it. And they actually even tried to make it, but it fell apart. And then they went to casting again and auditioned more people. They auditioned many, many, many people. And I just thought, well, they aren't interested in me. I let it go. And I also must say, at the time, I thought, I know, you know, he was going to be a priest and all that, and I know his movies, but really, he's going to do a period movie about Jesus, you know? I thought, wow, that's strange. I wasn't attracted to it. And then one day, I had come back from a movie that wasn't very satisfying. There were lots of difficulties, and I came back to the States and was like, oh, I gotta get back to the theater, you know? And I was teaching in a place in Massachusetts and staying very modestly at like a bed and breakfast kind of place. And there was only one phone, and the people that ran the bed and breakfast called me up and said, Willem, there's someone on the phone for you. And it was like my agent said, Marty Scorsese wants to see you tomorrow. And I said, really, about what? And they said, Last Temptation of Christ. And I said, yeah, what role? And they said, idiot, no, he wants to see you for Jesus. And I thought, that's strange. And I went to New York, I read the script, I loved it, and I said, oh, now I get it. I had, you know, I was prejudiced in my imagination about what this movie was because I didn't know the novel. And when I read it, I said, now I know why he wants to do me to do this. And I loved it. It was one of the best experiences I've had as far as total immersion, a lot of responsibility. You know, the world really dropped away. We're in Morocco, no trailers, nothing. We were out there. And we were working fast because it was a low-budget movie. But he had it planned very well. We had limited equipment, limited time, and I think that was good because it kept us away from, you know, the pageantry or gilding the lily. It was very essential. In fact, before we started it, the one thing he suggested that I looked at was Gospel According to Matthew, the Pasolini. Because
he
was the model.
In another movie.
That's another story. But no, it was a great experience.
And what's that like? So you, obviously, I can tell just from you talking about it was an incredible experience on set, and you must be so satisfied and energized.
And not for the reasons
end.
You think. Not because you're playing Jesus, because you're not thinking about that. No, I mean,
you can tell talking to you in terms of the creative process, it must have been a really satisfying and enriching process. So you're so happy that you've wrapped the film, but then comes this huge firestorm of controversy. What's that like psychologically to deal with?
That's a big question in a funny way. And I don't recall. I probably blocked it.
Yeah.
You know, when you do the movie, no matter how much you love it, you have to let it go a little bit. And some movies you continue, you know, when you're in the editing room and that sort of thing, particularly as I get older and I collaborate, like with Abel, I'm very close with him in post-production, Abel Ferrara, who I've worked with a lot lately. But normally, when I'm done rapping, and when I'm done shooting, I go off and make room for something else. So then when the movie comes out, it's like starting a whole something else. You're trying to recall what that experience was. You're trying to support the movie, because if you like it, you particularly you want it to be seen. So, they're two different things.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Intelligence Squared. Part 2 of this event will be available as our next episode. Subscribers can access both episodes now. We'd love to hear your feedback and what you think we should talk about next, who we should have on, and what our future debates should be. Send us an email or a voice note with your thoughts to podcasts@intelligencesquared.com or on Twitter @intelligence2. And if you'd like to hear more, attend some of our excellent events, or peruse over 20 years of our back catalogue featuring some of the world's greatest minds, then head over to intelligencesquared.com.